The last time, we mainly talked about forms of description and got down to reduction operations. Are there any questions about what we talked about last time? Okay, before we continue, let me give you a couple of cautions. By now, you are very likely to be doing a couple of things wrong. Number one, it's a strong tendency to jump ahead and try to use this material in some clinically relevant way. And at this point, I think that you better not expect that it'll work. It might if you're lucky, but it's too much like taking a carburetor and asking, what can you do with it? There's not a hell of a lot you can do with it until you hook it up with a motor and the wheels. So remember, we are still in the process of covering ground, and not till we have it all covered are we going to turn to using it. And in many respects, and for many purposes, you need all of the parts in place. You need to see how they work together in order to get some mileage out of it. So don't be too quick to try to apply it directly to therapy or to interviewing or to people, etc. The other thing is, don't read too much into it. Don't try to get insight into it. It's like trying to get insight into the alphabet. See, it's your starting point, and the most you can do is get familiar with it and then use it in the ways it can be used, but you don't do it via insight. Later on, there's plenty of room for insight, intuition, etc., but not at these beginning phases. So as I say, don't read any more into it than is there. It's a set of distinctions that I'm introducing. The distinctions interrelate with one another. They can be used in a certain way. And my commentary is about the various uses of these forms of description is itself a little bit of anticipation, but I think it pays to give some indication of some possible uses. So the two things don't do is don't go overboard in applying it clinically, and don't read more into it than is there. Okay, if there's no questions about last time, yeah. Yeah, I was going to continue. Oh, wait a minute. Oh. Two of those descriptions I made up just for that one occasion. And I've never done anything with them since. And that's one of them. Hey, look. We're still in business. Shows you how much this room gets used. The occasion was that this table was taken from a paper presented at the APA meeting. And for that occasion, I introduced the stimulus response description and the purposive description. Now, stimulus response description involves deleting everything but the KP and A. Now, what do you get out of this kind of pattern? Remember, I said that anything that traditionally would be called a stimulus will be one of the possible values of K. So you already have that. Now, consider the combination of simply the discrimination involved plus the performance and the outcome. And think of sounding a buzzer, and then the rat jumping over to a red triangle instead of a blue circle. You ask how much of the behavior in question are you getting at with this form of description, that rat jumping to the blue triangle pretty well fits. So if you exploit these parameters of intentional action, then you're conveying or committed to the kind of information that you generally get in a stimulus response paradigm. And that's.
Would K have sort of the double value of buzzer and blue, red?
Yeah. Yeah, you would have the buzzer versus silence or versus something else, and then the blue circle versus the red triangle. And see, part of the interest there is to figure out just what he was responding to. Was he responding separately to the blue and the triangle? Was he responding to the blue triangle as a single thing, etc.? Okay. Since I've talked about that, I might as well talk about the purpose of description. That's our first reduction operation anyhow. And the here's what the reduction amounts to. Let me explain. The notion of a reduction operation is that you stop making distinctions among the different parameters. And in that respect, it differs fundamentally from a deletion operation. In a deletion operation, you're simply not talking about certain parameters. With reduction, you're removing the distinction between them. Now, one of the reasons that you can do it easily, at least for some parameters, is recall that for these you had states of affairs as values, for these you had states of affairs as values, and for this you had states of affairs as values. For this you had process or state of affairs. So you can wipe out the distinctions among the parameters by saying, in effect, I don't want to categorize these states of affairs in these ways. I just want to talk about states of affairs. So I don't want to distinguish between knowledge type facts and motivational type facts and learning type facts. I just want to talk about various facts that may be relevant. So by doing that, then, you reduce the distinctions that are involved. But you can keep the same facts that enter in as values of parameters. With a reduction operation, you remove the distinctions between the parameters. But if you do it right, you can keep all of the facts that would have served as values of the parameters. The reason is that all of these values are specified by specifying states of affairs. And so you can regard the parameters as simply ways of categorizing states of affairs, and then you can say, I don't want to introduce those distinctions. I just want to talk about states of affairs. Now, this particular pattern corresponds, I think, pretty closely to a lot of the traditional philosophical literature in which there is reference to agents. See, normally philosophers will speak of a person as an agent. Agent is somebody who does things, who accomplishes things, who has effects on the world. And so by lumping together all of these aspects of behavior and connecting it to an achievement, you have the notion of an agent producing a result. And as I say, that corresponds pretty closely to the content of a lot of philosophical writing in which the notion of agent and agency is discussed. So this is a concept that has a long and honorable history. You can see that it corresponds to getting something done via behavior. You think of a person as causing things to happen. For example, if I toss a chalk, you think of me causing the chalk to fly through the air. And indeed, that is one of the achievements of my behavior. So that's why this division then will get you the agent and the result, the agency and the result. I didn't really give one. I said, if you think of a person as an individual that causes things to happen, that brings about effects in the world, then this will correspond to that. This is the effect that is brought about, and this is the way it's brought about. This is what brings it about. And if you don't separate it out into these aspects, you simply have that which brings about something. Or you say, under these various conditions, this is brought about.
In understanding the reduction operation as it applies to those states of affairs, you're talking in general terms then, or you're just using those states of affairs, but you're not categorizing.
Right. See, what happens is you've got a new category in which this one is C and this one is E. And that's why it appears the way it does on the diagram. On line 11, you see a sequence of four C's and then one E. And those replace these parameters. And the sequence of four C's is to say that these four are lumped together under one heading, namely C. And C is for cause and E is for effect.
That then results in kind of transmission of a concept. In other words, you're putting these four things together in order to make kind of a concept.
Oh, you're not putting them together. You're not distinguishing among them.
Right.
See, when you reduce, you're not somehow amalgamating them. You're just wiping out the distinctions.
But you're not relaying them?
No. To relate them, you would have to distinguish them.
It seemed that
see, that's why I say it amounts to saying, let's not talk about knowledge facts and motivational facts and learning facts. Let's just talk about facts. So that you're removing the distinction of knowledge, motivation, and learning. But you're keeping all of the facts that would fall under one or another of these headings.
Does that prevent you from getting caught up handling each one of those little things when you want to continue on with your description or whatever?
Which little things?
Well, these states of affairs.
No, because all of these states of affairs can be lumped together under the cause. So you haven't lost your hold on this, on the values of the parameters, you've lost your hold on the parameters. So anything that could have served as a value of K or W or SA can serve as a value of C. So it's the categorization that you wiped out, not the values.
So they're independent causes.
Well, if you put it in this form, you've got a cause-effect form.
Right, I see. Right, sure. Right, okay.
Now, the reason this is cause-effect is that the original is cause-effect. Come back to intentional action under this description. The achievement is the result that I have brought about by my behavior. So my bringing it about here is what shows up here as the cause-effect relationship. The fact that it is brought about, the fact that the occurrence of this, given this, is not at all accidental.
You did example, Pete, about chemists working with certain chemicals to distinguish me by cause and effect.
Go on.
Could you take an example of a chemist? Take a certain chemical, puts it in another chemical, and it has a certain effect.
Yeah. I'd assimilate that to the next one, not to this one particularly. That is to line 12 rather than to line 11. Here, what I want to point out is that what's built into intentional action per se is a cause-effect relation, because there is the bringing about something non-accidentally, and this parameter guarantees that it's non-accidental. So normal human behavior is a causal phenomena if you want to think in terms of causal phenomena. And in fact, I'd say that's the paradigm of causality, the bringing about of an effect non-accidentally. And you retain that feature even when you wipe out certain of the distinctions. Since it was there to begin with and you haven't wiped it out, it remains and shows up in the connection between C and D. It shows up because in the original, the occurrence of A, given the rest, was not accidental. Now, the more common one is line 12. And in that one, you reduce these three and then these two. And here's your cause and here's your effect. And this one is even neater than the other because you have a separation between things that happen and things that don't happen. See, states of affairs are not things that happen. In contrast, I said the process is something that happens at a given time and place. The event happens at a given time and place, and it happens as a result of the process. So these two things, the event or process that are going to be the values of P and A, are things that occur. These states of affairs are not things that occur. Instead, they are simply conditions. They are simply cases of something being the case. Now, because of that, you get an easy English translation of this formula, where you don't get an easy English translation of line 11. The English translation is, under certain conditions, something happens non-accidentally. And that is directly and explicitly a cause-effect description. Now, one of the major interests is this. It happens as a matter of historical fact that almost every psychologist who studies behavior, this is what he takes to be behavior, or rather, this. And psychologists are prone to look for the causes of behavior. And so they, in effect, make this kind of separation. They say, here's behavior, I want to know the causes. What kind of causes? There are these kinds of things. So you might say line 12 represents the formula that most psychologists have used in studying behavior. They've taken the performance to be the behavior. They've taken it as their business to discover the causes of behavior. And they've investigated these states of affairs that go with these performances. As, for example, in the stimulus and response tradition. And you recall I said that all values of W will appear in A, and that's why motivations are often thought of as a certain kind of stimulus. And obviously, logically, it doesn't matter a heck of a lot if you call them stimulus or if you call them controlling variables. Still going to be the same cause-effect arrangement. So this one is, as I say, of historical interest, and that this is the kind of formula, the kind of schema that most psychologists have used in their study of behavior.
What do you say about W being worse than A?
In K.
In A. K.
Yeah. See, I said from the very beginning that any value of W has to be a value of K, that you can't want something that you don't distinguish. Well, in the SR tradition, that fact has been formulated as motivation is a particular kind of stimulus. So you don't have a separate category of drive anymore. You simply have stimuli and you have motivational stimuli. Now, cause-effect descriptions have a particular value. It's not an accident that people have used it. Think again of a situation in which you have something you want to accomplish, but you don't know how to do it. That is, it's not something you can simply and directly do or bring about. Now, if all you had to go by is this, you'd be stuck right there. You don't know how to do it, then you can't get it done. However, once you have a cause-effect formula, you say, okay, here's my goal out here. If I can't do it directly, maybe I can discover a cause-effect relation in which this is the effect and something else is the cause. Now, if that something else that stands in a cause-effect relation to this is something that I know how to bring about, then, by gosh, I can bring about this too, by virtue of this connection. But you may not find that either. But you don't have to stop there. You can say, well, wait a while. As long as I've got this, let's look for another cause-effect connection such that this cause is the effect of still another cause. And if this one is something I know how to do, then by gosh, I can still bring this about, given these connections. You can see that you can just keep going as long as you can find cause-effect connections. You can keep going and hope that at some point, one of those causes is something you know how to bring about. And then, by virtue of these connections, you can bring about the thing that you wanted to. So cause-effect connections then have their primary value in extending the human range of ability to get something done. If given connections of this sort, you're not stuck with just what you can accomplish directly. You also can extend to things that you can accomplish indirectly via cause-effect connection. Secondly, independently of manipulating those things, they also have a bearing on what you can expect. If you know of connections of this sort and you observe something like that, then you can expect that the rest will follow unless something happens to prevent it. So you extend both manipulative ability, that is the ability to get something done, and you extend the range of your legitimate expectations. Because given these connections and this observation, it is legitimate to expect that this will occur unless something happens to prevent it. And, of course, it may have some value even if you can't change it, and if it impinges upon you, it may give you time to prepare for it. Like if you see the storm building up over there, maybe you can't do anything about it, but you can get inside or do something else. So those are the two major values, then, of cause-effect formulations. That where we find things that fit cause-effect formulas, they do extend our observational and manipulative abilities. But notice that they extend our abilities. If you didn't have something like this in the picture, there would be of no value whatever. There'd be nothing to extend. So think of either K or A as being connected to causal change. Either you make an observation and it extends your knowledge, or you produce something and it extends your ability to create facts. But on this end of it is intentional action. Okay, now I've said that all of these are simply the kinds of formulas that you could generate immediately and easily using these four operations. That since these operations are recursive, clearly you could take any change and keep making further changes on it. And you could add in some places and delete in others, expand it, put it in the form of cause-effect, and put that in the form of K, etc. So that with this calculational system, you can generate behavioral formulas that are as complex as you want, as finely differentiated as you want, as extensive as you want. And in fact, you can generate an infinite number of different forms of description and an infinite variety of different forms. Because of that, given mastery of this system, there is no behavior that could occur that you wouldn't have a representation for. And it's because of your mastery of something like that that you can recognize behaviors that you never saw before, or engage in behaviors that you never tried out before. This is an extension of what is clearly true of language. Once you know the language, you can recognize sentences that you never heard before and say sentences that you never said before. Because your ability to say them non-accidentally is not based on a repetition of the same sentence. It's not based on that kind of learning. It's based on the mastery of a system that you then operate to generate genuinely new things, or to recognize genuinely new things. So the whole notion of mastering a calculational system is a far cry from learning a label for something. And the kind of concept that is a calculational system is a very different sort of concept from the kind of concept that serves as a label. For example, the word white. If you ask, what can you do if you have the concept of white? Well, you can distinguish white things from other things. You say, what can you do if you have the concept of arithmetic? You can solve a limitless number of specific arithmetic problems. So the one kind of conceptual mastery is a lot like having a skill. It's a lot like knowing how to do something, like knowing how to ride a bicycle. And quite a bit unlike having a label for something. So back to where we took off from, namely that using the concept of behavior, there's a good deal of difference whether you're using it in a simple label-like way to say there's a case of behavior, versus if you're using it as a calculational system where once you have that concept available, you can generate an infinite variety of concepts of behavior and thereby recognize any sort of behavior, or at least have some representation for any sort of behavior that occurs, be able, in principle at least, to distinguish any two behaviors that you encounter. So there's a tremendous amount of difference when you're talking about using that concept of behavior. The difference stems from the fact that its use is as a calculational system and not as a label, not as a name, not as a simple distinction. So you can say it's because people learn that sort of learning, it's that sort of concept, and they master it, that they have the facility that they do, and that they observably do, in both recognizing and generating novel behaviors. And that no matter what behavior occurs, you have a representation for it. All of that by virtue of a single concept. Now, secondly, given the notions that we've developed, come back to the notion of an achievement description, where we're referring merely to the result that is produced or accomplished. Now think of the notion of an operation and of performing an operation on an element and generating a product. Given the terminology that we now have arrived at, we can say that the performing of an operation is itself a case of intentional action under an achievement description. That it is something that you could be said to have accomplished. There isn't necessarily any performance that goes with it. But it is certainly a result you can be said to have accomplished. Compare it to this. You say, what did he accomplish? The obvious answer is he added 4 and 3. Now you saw me write down the 4, and you saw me write down the 3, and you saw me put the line down, and you saw me write down the 7. You did not see me add 4 and 3. Unless you say, well, that was you're adding 4 and 3. See, but there's not some part of the procedure of writing these numbers down where you say, there is where he was doing the adding. Instead, you say, well, since 7 is the answer to 4 plus 3, his putting the number 7 down is a case, at least under an achievement description, of his adding. So given an achievement description, you don't have to hypothesize, for example, an internal process of addition. Neither do you have to reduce it to simply making marks on the blackboard. To say is, we saw a performance, and it's not clear what the action was, but I can tell you one of the achievements was that he added 4 and 3. Now, in the same sense, see, performing an operation on an element and getting a product, you're never going to see somebody performing an operation on an element. There is not a performance that goes with it, but you can see the result in what he says. You can look at what a person says and say, well, if it's this kind of description, clearly he must have performed this operation to get that product. But what you really see is the result. And seeing it as the result of an operation is a reconstruction. And you can talk about it that way under achievement descriptions. You'd be sticking your neck out if you invented a hypothetical process to go along with it. There might not be any. Now, if you look at all of the elements of the table, you see that the initial element is the notion of intentional action, that the operations are intentional actions under an achievement description, that the products are forms of description of intentional actions, and that the giving of such descriptions is intentional action. What you see is that at all points in the use of this as a calculational system, you haven't gone beyond the notion of intentional action. But you don't have to appeal to any other notion than intentional action in order to get this whole thing as a calculational system. So when I say that the notion of intentional action is a calculational system, I have in mind just such facts. You don't have to appeal to any other notion to get this whole system and its operation. Now, we do not have convenient ways of distinguishing among these various forms of description. We do not have in ordinary English or in any other technical system ways of distinguishing between deliberate actions, intentional actions, activity descriptions, performance descriptions, achievement descriptions, etc. Now, it's not that we can't give descriptions of this sort, it's that when we talk, it's hard to know which of them we're giving. For example, if I said she's sitting down in a chair, there is none of these forms of description that I couldn't be giving by saying that. There is not in English a separate way of talking for each of these forms of description. And because of that, ordinary English has that kind of ambiguity. Now, it's not a necessary ambiguity, because if you want to know which form of description I'm giving, you ask me. You ask me which things I'm committed to. And by asking me those kinds of questions, you can find out what kind of description I was giving. But you have to work at it. It doesn't come just in my initial statement. Once you have these systematic development and the terms, you can bypass a lot of chit-chat simply by labeling your description as an achievement description, or as an activity description, or as a deliberate action description, etc. So these terms are technical terms, and they're used to identify certain forms of description, and I've introduced them because there is no other existing terms that will do the job. Okay, any questions now about any of the features of the forms of description of the notion of intentional action as a calculational system? Okay, then let's touch base again where we came from. Recall we're developing the general case of behavior, and we said it divides up into the notion of person and the general notion of behavior, and that one was this. Then we said in the special case of the observer describer, what distinguishes him is that his behavior is verbal, and we had a formula for that. And then we said, and secondly, that he uses the concept of behavior. And it's this that we've been dealing with now, with the notion of intentional action as a calculational system. Because the question was, how does he use it in his behavior? And the answer is, he uses it as a calculational system. So the expansion of intentional action as a calculational system fits here in elaborating what an observer describer has available for understanding and responding to behavior. What we see is he has a hell of a lot available, not just a single label. Okay, now in getting here, I said we could, since we started from here, we could equally well go down here or up here, and then chose to do it this way. At this point, then, let's come back and pick up our second half here and go to the notion of person. For the notion of person, we can give a peculiar kind of definition which amounts to a paradigm case formulation. And the definition is this: a person is an individual whose history is paradigmatically a history of intentional action. Now, what does this do? What does this introduce beyond the notion of intentional action? What it introduces is the notion of a history. So let's introduce a conventional notation for history, beginning from birth and ending in death. It's a life history. Think of that history of consisting of some number of episodes. And now think of each episode as consisting of an intentional action. And then we say, paradigmatically, that is a representation of a person. A person is a life history in which the episodes in that life history consist of intentional action. Now, the reason the word paradigmatically is there is that this definition does not directly fit the facts. Clearly, most people spend roughly one-third of their lives not engaging in intentional action, namely when they're asleep. So as a direct definition, this would obviously not hit the mark. However, if we introduce this as a paradigm case formulation, we can see that we can later recover the difference and come out even. Furthermore, it would be hard to come out even any other way. Now, what potentialities do we have here for one person being the same as or being different from another person? We just take it at the level of description of saying a life history, which is a sequence of intentional actions, everybody's going to look the same. What potentials have we introduced for differences among people? Well, we already have one over here, namely that our analysis of behavior gives us ways of distinguishing one behavior or one kind of behavior from another. So since we can already do that, we can say people might be distinguished, these life histories might be distinguished by the kinds of behaviors that occur in them. And clearly that's a possibility. That is one way that life histories differ, is in which kinds of behaviors occur. However, that's a set of distinctions that just goes with the notion of behavior. You wouldn't have needed a life history notion to get that sort of difference. The next one is, these life histories can differ not merely in the kinds of behaviors that occur, but also in their patterns of occurrence. For example, take any single kind of behavior. And to keep with our earlier example, consider cases of hostile behavior. And then let's shade each behavior that is hostile behavior. imagine this kind of difference between life histories. In each case, the shaded ones represent hostile behaviors. How would you characterize these differences? So here we have a case of three occurrences. Here we have a case of three occurrences. But these three are all in a row, whereas these are distributed. Here we have a case of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 occurrences. And they're not in a row like this. They're kind of spread around like this. Now, considering that the number of episodes in a person's lifetime are much greater than the number that I've drawn here, you can see that if you took all of the combinations of patterns of this sort, the number is astronomical. And since the number is astronomical, clearly we're not going to have different terms for each possible pattern. Instead, we're going to have some kind of categorization, a finite set of categories that will make some distinctions that we have some use for. Now, begin by thinking of how one would distinguish one of these from another. And take as your first answer that you do it by specifying, number one, a type of behavior, and number two, a pattern of occurrence. It is a pattern of occurrence for that type of behavior. Now let's see where that gets us. Consider the case where the type of behavior is just any type that you can distinguish. Hostile, friendly, generous, cowardly, drinking behavior, behavior that involves cans, any behavior that you can distinguish. And the pattern is simply frequency. Take the example of hostility. That hostility would be the type of behavior. Frequency would mean this one, say, that is, a history in which there was a lot of that type of behavior. Now, if you have a case like that, you would say, here is a hostile person. And to say that is to give a trait description. You're saying he has the trait of hostility. Now, one of the natural questions that arises is, well, how frequent is frequent? How many does it take? And the answer is enough. See, when you say of a person that he's a hostile person, saying that is not a substitute for some number of hostile behaviors in his life. You normally are not in a position to count them, and even if you did, you wouldn't know what to do with the number. The force of saying that this is a hostile person is that this person, you can expect more of that sort of thing than you could from just any old person. That he differs from most people in this respect. That the frequency will be enough higher to be worth commenting on.